Hello, hello, you fellow freaks. I am Zach, your host of the Auxoro podcast, where music artists, athletes, entrepreneurs, and other interesting human beings dive deep into the story beyond the surface. We are a completely independent platform, and there are a few ways in which you can support this podcast. Number one, you can subscribe, leave a review, and rate us on the iTunes store. This helps us appear higher in searches, which means more people will find out about these conversations. Number two, you can tell a friend, write a blog post, and tag us on social media. I promise we will get back to you. And number three, you can slide us some dollar bills with the support link in the description of this podcast. All production, equipment, and travel expenses are paid out of pocket, and a few bucks really does go a long way. This episode is brought to you by The Aux, an email newsletter bringing you the five coolest things that we discover each week. Just last week, we explored Dave Chappelle, Instagram hacks, and Playboy magazine censorship. Fun stuff. If you're ready to take your cool to the next level, at least our version of cool, you can subscribe to The Aux by clicking the link in the description of this podcast or by visiting auxoro.com/The Aux. That's A-U-X. This time, we sat down with Randall Kuna, a well-respected neuroscientist and founder of carboncopies.org, the outreach and roadmapping organization for advancing substrate-independent minds. Now, what is a substrate-independent mind? Fair question. According to Carbon Copies, substrate independence is when our cognitive processes are then no longer tied to a single version of the brain's processing architecture. Instead, our thoughts and feelings will be able to exist on a variety of processing substrates. In other words, our minds, our consciousness, can exist outside of our brains, the mushy stuff, potentially forever on another substrate or platform. Randall Kuna has dedicated his life to mind uploading, whole brain emulation, and making it possible, as he puts it, to choose our brain and body as much as we can choose our winter or summer clothes to suit our needs. Randall explains the concept of mind uploading and its implications far better than I will ever be able to, so I'll let him take it from here. This topic is important, and although mind uploading may not seem like a reality at the moment, it may be closer than you think, and in many ways is already here. And it can solve many of the problems that we deal with today, as we are so limited by our biology. So without further ado, here's our wide-ranging conversation with neuroscientist Randall Kuna. So I thought a good place to start, I was doing some digging and I saw that your introduction into, I guess, the exploration of the human mind was pretty early on in your life, the concept of exploring the human mind. At 13 years old, you came across a book called The City and the Stars by Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah.
And for people that are not familiar with the plot of the book, and I've never read it either, it is residents that live multiple lives and they spend time between these lives kind of stored in memory banks, from what I understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a central computer capable of creating human bodies. First of all, how did you come across this at 13 years old? Because most people, I assume, at 13 are not reading novels that are that dense. And second, how did that sort of spark your interest in the human mind?
So I think the sparking of the interest in the human mind, I think that was kind of something that was already going on in parallel. And this just sort of focused the matter on, oh, hey, you know, all of this stuff can be replicated because all of it is just matter of one kind or another, right? I don't know if it's true that there aren't that many people who would read this sort of science fiction at 13. I think that Arthur C. Clarke is very accessible to certainly, you know, young teenagers. He does tend to write what's called, you know, sort of the hard science fiction, serious science fiction, in the sense that he sticks with the mm-hmm. laws of physics to the, you know, largely with the laws of physics. So there's that. But he explores things that tend to be just sort of logical outcomes when you just think things through. So, for instance, in that particular book, really what he was just thinking through is, all right, you know, matter is the same, you know, the stuff that's inside of us is the same as what's inside stars, just as Carl Sagan said, you know, we're all stardust. And it really doesn't make that much difference. It's just that it's arranged in a certain way. And all of those patterns, they could be something that emerged naturally, or it could be something that you put together in a machine. It doesn't make that much difference. In the end, you've got the same thing. And he was just sort of taking that all the way. And I think because it's such a rational construct, the way he puts the stories together, it's actually very easy to follow. Even for a young mind, someone who, you know, is still, you know, in school and, you know, hasn't had any university classes on advanced physics or anything like that, it's pretty easy to follow. And it all makes sense. In fact, it's so much so, it makes so much sense that I wonder sometimes why this sort of thinking isn't more prevalent. Why the kind of things that he was writing about in the 50s isn't something that is simply common knowledge everywhere.
Yeah, maybe I think I definitely was making unfair generalizations of 13-year-olds. Maybe it was just me and my friends that really didn't read that much around that age, but other 13-year-olds were. I didn't get in a steady reading habit until later in high school and college, but it sounds like this book is able to lay out or sort of like you were saying, presenting humans as information where you can kind of construct and deconstruct things. Were you thinking about sort of the parallel implications for yourself and for other human beings while you were reading this book? Or was it just kind of something that you had read and then kind of kept stewing in the back of your mind until you had a chance to explore it yourself?
No, I think I was already thinking about some of these concepts before I even opened the book. My dad is a physicist and, you know, he's a particle physicist, in fact. So a lot of the things that appeared in the book afterward were things that were already being discussed at home. So this whole notion of how the universe is this mass of particles that emerged from somewhere and get arranged through some forces and some laws and that can be rearranged, that was already there. And I think it's a very programmatic thinking about life, the universe, and everything. It's kind of a, oh, here, this is beautiful clockwork, this thing that, sure, it's governed by quantum physics, but quantum physics mm-hmm. is also computable, right? It's completely computable. The only things that exist in the universe are either deterministic things, so things that run like a program, or non-deterministic things, meaning they are not predictable. They may be probabilistic, but they're not predictable. So all of that is part of something you can stuff into a model. And the universe is like a model, except that it's the model we live in. And that's the sort of thinking that was already there. And then when you add on, you know, the contents of that book, where it's just spelled out directly that this is something you can apply to people, then you go, oh, you know, that's really interesting. If you wanted to change something about who we are, you can do that because that's within your grasp. It's all a blueprint mm-hmm. of some kind. And if you wanted to be able to store what we are and take that to a future time and then reconstruct what we are, that should also be possible because, again, it's a blueprint and you're just putting that blueprint into form. You're giving it form with matter.
I want to get into the actual definitions of whole grain emulation, substrate independence, and mind uploading. But I think before that, maybe a good place to kind of jump from would be, what do you think is the barrier for most people not willing to engage in this type of thinking or not being exposed to this type of thinking? I know I definitely was not open to the mind as kind of a machine and a construct, and the fact that everything that does exist exists within our minds, everything that we sense and feel and taste and touch, until I started exploring meditation about a year and a year and a half ago. And not everyone is studying things in the realm of whole brain emulation. Why do you think this isn't more mainstream and more of a concern in people's minds?
I actually think that there are probably many different reasons why it's not something that many people have thought about or that people would easily gravitate toward. So many, many different reasons, and we should probably treat them differently. But what you mentioned about meditation, it's true. It's a really surprising how much of what the basic assumptions are, the basic hypotheses that go into something like whole brain emulation, the idea that you can create another kind of device that will also produce the same sort of experience of a mind and of being able to experience the universe as what this biological machine that we have on our shoulders is doing. A lot of the things that are behind that, they are thoughts, they're concepts, ideas, and understanding that it turns out that Eastern philosophy and meditation has also come to those same conclusions in a way, although sometimes it's tinged with a certain amount of spirituality that I can't necessarily find a good alignment for. But it's actually interesting. I had no connection with meditation until very late. I was already deeply into all of this scientific stuff for decades before I ever tried to meditate for the first time, or before I tried to study any of what the what Buddhism was about and what Eastern philosophy was about. Now I find it very interesting to see the parallels, even though it's very clear that they were developed from a different angle than Western science, the science that we got from the scientific revolution mm-hmm. onward. But it seems like a lot of the things that make sense from a scientific point of view are the sort of things that you can also arrive at when you think about what's actually going on at the moment, what you're actually experiencing at the moment, what is real, what is not real, what is a construct which you have control over in some sense, and what is a part of your biology in a sense. And in meditation, it seems like a lot of what you're doing is you're kind of clarifying what's going on and allowing it to settle in a way where you can tell, what is basically just some routine that is, a flood of things that are coming over you and that you then react to versus, what's, I guess, quote unquote, real. But so you were asking about the hurdles, why it is hard for people to think in terms of whole brain emulation or mind uploading and why that makes sense.
Yeah.
And like I said, there are many different reasons. And it's not just that, that it takes some introspection to get there yourself through something like meditation, but it's also that we've been taught for a very long time that there is some kind of unique and special spark in humanity. There's this concept of the human soul, right? And it's something that doesn't belong to us, but it belongs somewhere out there in the ether, even though we know there is no such thing as the ether, but spiritual ether, whatever you want to call it. And so it's a dualist notion. It's this idea that the body is a vessel, and inside that vessel, there is a spirit. Now, this is really interesting because on the one hand, you would think that gets you closer to something like mind uploading because you can conceive of the notion that your body could be exchanged.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it doesn't, because then the spirit is this thing that is inviolable. And that is somehow outside of physics, and that is, it's eternal somehow, and it just inhabits bodies, and then it's not something that can be generated by the way that a biological mechanism or a non-biological mechanism works. So that's one thing, is that this sort of notion of being special in some sense that kind of gets in the way. And, it doesn't have to. I think when you listen to people like Carl Sagan and others who were very good about describing science to the public, you can see that there are ways to be very rational and scientific and leave out all the spirituality and to still have a sense of awe, a sense of mystery, a sense that there is something really fantastic going on here. So you don't need to let go of all of that just to be able to have a very clear and rational view of who we are and where we are.
And listening to some of your lectures and other people that are in the same field or a tangential field, one of the points that they seem to hammer home is that there is no magic in the brain, like you were alluding to, that you can take parts of the brain, take it apart, understand how it works. You can look at all of the links between neurons and analyze certain spikes that lead to emotions or thinking patterns. And even though that, you know, we aren't all the way there yet, obviously. And I've heard you say that when you ask a neuroscientist if he understands the brain, that he'll say no, because there's so many things that we don't yet have any idea about. But I could see how people may be not able to fend with the concept that we aren't special, or that there is no magical element to each and every person on this planet, and that it can be replicated and built and stripped down and rebuilt again. I guess that ties back into meditation too, with the ego and kind of taking a step back and observing your emotions and observing your thoughts without reacting to them, and seeing that the ego is something that you can separate from and does not control you. And meditation to this was an interesting tie-in for me, because this was one of the first things, meditation was one of the first things that I thought of when I started going through your work available online. And it's cool to hear too that you've also gotten into meditation as well.
Yeah, pretty recently actually, just 5 years ago.
How did you get into it?
Largely because my partner is deeply into meditation, and she taught me a lot of things, and I just tried them out, and I realized that it was very useful to me as a tool, at least, you know, for my daily life. And then, you know, you start exploring a bit further. So this is one of those situations where I should say that I probably had a bias, you know? I came at it knowing a lot of people who do meditation, but who speak in terms that sound very non-scientific. You know, they have a different approach to it. They come from a different angle. You might almost call it New Age, or you may actually call it New Age. And then a lot of the stuff that people will mention sounds like it's not really based on anything justifiable. And for someone who has a science background, sometimes that can be, you know, a bit off-putting. But, you know, in time, I've learned that very often it's just that we don't have the same terminology. We don't have the same language in which we speak about things. But sometimes we mean things that are actually the same or very similar. And so the realizations that you come to are actually kind of similar and the same, and they make sense. They're rationally derived. It's just that there's a different vernacular that comes along with it. I think that's something that I kind of had to get over myself there a little bit. I had to just sort of push out that bias, and that made it much easier to realize that there was another angle for coming at things like what you just mentioned, understanding more about the ego and its place, and how much of it is actually something that you're generating and producing, and that it is possible to set it aside a bit and take a more objective perspective. So yeah.
I don't have the vocabulary or the knowledge to describe what's happening in my brain on a scientific level while I meditate, or the after effects of meditation. But I do know that when I'm just walking around and talking to people during the day, I do feel much less reactive than if I go through spans where I'm not meditating. It seems like there's a slight space or split second if someone says something to me or insults me or compliments me. It could be anything. There's a little bit of a gap where I take things in and kind of think about it for a sec before I respond, or maybe just notice a breath or something, and then I give my response. Where before meditation, I definitely was not doing that. And I also grew up heavy in the baseball athletics world, where there's this huge competitive bravado and you're not supposed to talk about your emotions a lot and can be seen as a weakness. So I was much more reactive than I am now, but I can definitely see the benefits of it and how it seems like it can kind of rewire your brain and how you interact with people.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So would you be able to define for people who aren't familiar with whole brain emulation? So define whole brain emulation and substrate independence and how those two are intertwined, because it's such a basis of what you do, a foundation of what you do.
Yeah, actually the term whole brain emulation is one that arose while trying to explain in less confusing terms what the technological process would be, or the method for getting to what's, you know, known as a mind upload in science fiction terms. I'm still not sure that that worked out perfectly. There's still some confusion about what it means. But at least the idea was, okay, we already know the term emulation. We use it a lot, for example, in computing, where you can emulate one platform on another. So say, for instance, you could have an emulator that allows you to run Android apps on your PC, or mm-hmm. that allows you to run a piece of software that was written for a Mac on your PC, or the other way around. You could have emulators for old computer systems that don't exist anymore, like, you know, your old Commodore 64 or Amiga or something like that, and you could run that on a modern computer. And the idea there is that even though the hardware platform is different, the software, the instructions, the thing that makes it go, those are being interpreted the same way, and they produce the same results. And that's the idea here as well. With whole brain emulation, you want to be able to take all of the parts of the brain, so all of the things that are relevant to our experience of being, our experience of existing and sensing and reacting and feeling and all of that, and recreate that through an emulation of what's going on in the brain. And a really simple example, I guess you could point to the sort of simulations that are being done in computational neuroscience right now. Computational neuroscientists are constantly trying to simulate what's going on in different parts of the brain to show how, say, an animal manages to carry out a certain task, find a reward somewhere, or how human memory works, how we acquire new memories. These sorts of simulations are very instructive for learning how the brain works, but they're still very simple in the sense that they are often highly simplified. They use aspects of how those parts of the brain work that are common to the brains of all humans or all mice. And they're not certainly not specific to one individual. You wouldn't say that this is the simulation, the model that shows how your grandmother's brain worked or something like that. But that's exactly what whole brain emulation is trying to do. The idea is that you could make a model like that for the brain of a specific patient, and then that patient's brain could be run, or the same processes that were in the patient's brain could be run on some other kind of machine, whether it's a special purpose device developed for that, or if it's a, you know, a typical computer but running complicated software. And that the result would be that the mind, the cognitive functions that are emerging from that program or that device are again generating that mind. They're again generating that experience, which is the same as if it was your biological brain. Then there are all sorts of ancillary issues that you have to worry about, such as embodiment. You know, if you're going to have a brain again, that brain needs to be connected to something. You want to be able to sense that you're in an environment and that you have a body and all that sort of thing. So there are more things that come into play, but essentially it's about that. It's taking a piece of the brain or all of the brain and running it on some other platform. Now, the term substrate independent mind, again, this is one that was meant to be clarifying but can be confusing. It means that once you can create emulations like that, once you can take the function of these parts of the brain that generate the mind, I try to separate brain and mind that way. Once you can create an emulation like that, in theory, you could run an emulation like it because you now know the program, let's just say. You could run it on all sorts of different types of platforms. You might run it on some kind of neuromorphic hardware. You could run it on a special purpose device you built just for that. You could run it on a normal computer or on a supercomputer. That means it's no longer fully dependent on the substrate that it was in. It's no longer dependent on the organic matter that was generating those thoughts before. So in that sense, the mind has become substrate independent, not independent in the sense that it doesn't need a substrate. So there's no pure energy being or some nonsense like that.
So you can't just have like a floating orb of a mind with nothing there for it to grasp onto.
Absolutely not. What would that even be in physical terms? I mean, how does that run the brain?
I don't know. It's probably in a Marvel movie or something.
Yeah, you know. But sure.
So when you talk about brain, you're referring to the hardware, the squishy stuff in our head. And then when you say mind, that's the software.
I try to be good about that. I try to separate it that way to say that the brain is the hardware, is the squishy stuff, and the mind is the cognitive functions that are emerging from that, the things we can do with our brain.
I like the computer coding analogy because you can say that to an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old and show them two different operating systems. You can say, you know, this kid, your friend has an Android and you have an iPhone. You can essentially take the software of an iPhone and make it run on an Android. And that's, I might not be saying it the right way, but in terms of operating systems and what kids are used to handling, and if you're trying to make people that may not have an in-depth knowledge like myself or people that are interested in sort of getting into this field, I could see that as being a starting point to grab onto.
Yeah, I think especially for people who are familiar with computing in some way or another, that's a great way to start. Of course, the majority of the world still doesn't program, so it may not be the best analogy for them.
Yeah, it's on the rise, but it the majority of the world, yeah, does still not program. When you're thinking about the mind in terms of parts and how specific to get and how minute to break down these different parts, how do you know how far you have to go in order to recreate consciousness? Because I'm assuming that the end goal would be to create the same experience. If I'm experiencing what I'm experiencing now with all my senses and it feels exactly the same, that would be the end goal. So you wouldn't necessarily need to sort of make an exact copy of the brain if you didn't need to go that deep. How do you know how specific to get and how finely to break it apart?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Actually, there's a scientific term for that question. It's scale separation. Anytime you're dealing with a complex system, there's a question whether scale separation is possible. If there is some level where you could replace all of the underlying mechanisms or the underlying functions, and as long as you do it the right way, then all of the results above that stay the same. And whether that's possible in a system like the brain is actually still an open question, because we're not entirely sure. If it's a chaotic system in the sense that the details run all the way up and down and make a difference in that sense. But it gets even more nuanced than that, because even if you did have a chaotic system like that and you couldn't carry out pure scale separation, there's still the question, does it matter? If you can't separate the scales completely and the output, what your new emulated brain is doing is ever so slightly different than what would have happened if the same instant, the same state were running on the biological brain, does it still fall within the range of possible outputs that the biological brain would have produced? Because we know that neurons and synapses are not precise. They don't actually respond the same way every time. So there is a probabilistic sort of bell curve under which everything happens. There's a bell curve for the neuron responding. There's a bell curve for every synapse responding. So the path, the method by which your brain will create thoughts and your mind will progress, is it within this cone of possibilities that would still fall within what your biological brain might have done? That's the important question there. If you're talking about, has an emulation been successful? Is it still producing thoughts that make sense, that would make sense, that could have happened if it was still your biological brain? Maybe not the exact same path, but one of the paths that you could have taken. So scale separation doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be something where we can say for sure, yes, we can do scale separation here. The question is, can we practically do a scale separation that is perceptibly okay? You know, it meets our criteria for successful mind uploading. And whether we can is really an experimental process right now. There are a number of, I would say, consensus assumptions right now about how the brain does what it does. And they're based on experimental results and what seems to matter and what doesn't seem to matter, what seems to make a difference and what doesn't seem to make a difference. And so far, largely, this has come down to neurons talking to other neurons through electric potentials, through these spikes. Every time they manage to do that, and whatever you're fiddling with, whatever you're, you know, you're just making a little change here or there that doesn't change that kind of code transmission, then the cognitive function still seems to work. If you're doing something that changes those action potentials, that changes that type of coding, then suddenly the cognitive function changes as well. And either, say, memory doesn't work anymore, or you've implanted a false memory, or the rat can no longer find the goal, or something like that. So it seems that experimentally so far, what we found is that what really matters is that you understand which type of synapses you're dealing with so that you know whether or not they are going to be inhibiting or exciting the neuron after that they're leading to, and how much so, and with what time response, and that it matters how those neurons respond. What type of neuron is it? When will it fire? When it fires, how does it fire? Does it fire with a train of pulses or a single pulse? So you have to identify the kind of neuron, you have to identify the kind of synapse, and you have a set of models for how those work. It's at that level where we found the kinds of differences that seem to make a difference at this point. And below that, so far, not so much. There's a slightly lower level where molecular changes make a difference when you're talking about new memory formation. So LTP, LTD, long-term potentiation and long-term depression, these are processes that happen in neurons as they're learning something. And at that point, there's a molecular chain reaction that happens. And when you break a part of that chain, it changes how memory formation works. So there's something there that needs to be modeled correctly for the for memory formation. And that's a little bit more detailed than just classifying synapses and neurons. But beyond that, so far, there's no justifiable evidence for something that impacts cognitive function. And we can only work with what we know so far. So the models we build right now are based on those results. And then what you do is you build a model and you test how well it works. You discover what it's not doing right. And that's how you try to correct your initial assumptions. And this is how science is always going to work. It's always this cycle, this iteration of, here are my hypotheses, and now we're testing these hypotheses, and then we adjust and improve our hypotheses. So I don't think it's going to be a case of, okay, we found the theory and now we can make whole brain emulation. What's going to happen is we can make emulations, or let's call them neural prosthesis in the beginning. They're just going to be replacement parts for pieces of the brain. And they work to an extent. They help a patient who has a deficit somewhere no longer have that deficit completely. They can, for instance, still get, you know, create new memories where previously they couldn't. I'm talking about the hippocampal prosthesis here, for instance. That's a great example.
Yeah, well, I was going to bring up the Ted Berger experiment, because if you say you're like me and you're very unfamiliar with whole brain emulation, and then you just start searching around on Google and YouTube, what comes up a lot is the Ted Berger experiment. And from what I understand, he created a cognitive neural prosthetic that replaced part of the hippocampus in a rat brain.
Yes.
Would you be able to lay out the experiment in, I guess, enough detail for people to understand why the results are so important and what that means for whole brain emulation?
Yeah. So first of all, it's important to understand how he built the prosthesis. And this is why I was going to say that, you know, it's an iterative process. This prosthesis that he's got right now works to a degree, but it could be better. And on every iteration, it gets better. And this is because what he does is, in the rat, and in humans. This has been done now in rats, in primates, and in human patients, and successful in each case. There is this little area of the brain called the hippocampus that's essential for formation of new memories. It's a place that kind of filters memories as they come in and builds a quick tag for them. And then the actual memory is stored somewhere else in the brain. It's just, this is a pointer that points to that memory, basically. And the hippocampus contains two areas that are essential for the process. And those regions are called CA1 and CA3. CA3 points to CA1. It's almost a feed-forward network. It just points from CA3 to CA1. There are some recurrent connections. Most of those are just inhibitory connections, so they regulate when the whole system is down and when it's active. That's because activity in the brain is typically oscillatory. So it's like every so many milliseconds, you get another iteration of activity in the part of the brain. And the interneurons make sure that it happens regularly. That's kind of paced, almost like the clock in a computer. But the rest of these excitatory pathways, they're one feed forward path from CA3 to CA1. So that made it really easy to work with because it was a part of the brain that didn't need a lot more explanation in terms of its structure. You could build a model fairly easily. And in fact, this precise wiring wasn't that important because this part of the brain, the neurons in there, it's like a pointer in the computer that can point to any part that it's attached to, you know, can point to some region in the memory of the computer, but it can be reused. You can point it somewhere else. And so these neurons get reused. They get refreshed and reused over time. And that means you didn't need the exact wiring. It's not like there's a fixed wiring there that, you know, shows the way that, you know, a memory of the face of your grandmother or something like that. And what he was able to do, he was able to put probes into CA3 and into CA1. Those are just, you know, little electrical contacts where he can measure the activity going on in that area. And they weren't even that many. It was something like 60 in CA3 and CA1. And he was able to record from those probes, and he was able to identify different neurons because you can look at the shape of the response of each neuron and identify each unique neuron that way, sort of like a fingerprint. And so he could record which neuron was doing what at what time. And that way he got a series of neural activities for say, I don't know, something like 30 to 100 neurons in that area of the brain. And he was able to put that in a model. And the model's job was to look at the data that was recorded, you know, how activity in CA3 appears as a result of activity in CA1, because we know it's a feed-forward network, and to make predictions, to be able to predict the sort of activity that should be happening in CA3 when a pattern of activity happens in CA1. And this predictive network, that is the basis of a neural prosthesis. The idea is if you can produce the expected pattern of activity in CA3 in CA1 as a result of the activity in CA3, it's a little confusing because 3 points to 1 and not 1 to 3, then you've got a model that could take the place of that piece of the brain. So, and if a model can take over the function of that piece of the brain or support it, then you have a prosthesis, something that is a prosthetic replacement for that piece of the brain. And that's what he did. He built a model like that. He and his lab, this is not just him, of course. And they tested it by putting it into rats and having them do a task where they needed to use We need to be able to form new memories to carry out the task. And I won't get into the details there because it's just going to be sidetracking us. The point is, they could not carry out the task when the hippocampus wasn't working. And they could do that by injecting a chemical that made it impossible for the neurons in CA3 and CA1 to work the way they were supposed to. And so then the rat was unable to do the task. When you turn on the model, then they're again able to carry out the task. And if you have the model and the hippocampus both active, they were even slightly better at doing the task than they were previously. That was a great result. And then they showed the same result in primates, in macaque monkeys. And then they did the same thing in human patients. So they've got an ongoing project now. It's DARPA funded, and they're doing this at a number of hospitals, primarily in LA. they have patients there who have deficits in the hippocampus bilaterally due to either a stroke, epilepsy, or some other cause. And they implant a device that acts as this prosthesis. So basically, these are probes, again, that go into CA3 and CA1. They learn from the patient the coding that their brain uses as CA3 speaks to CA1. They build a model specifically for that patient. So this is a patient-specific emulation of that piece of the brain. And they use that to help the patient be able to do better at memory tasks than they were before because of the deficit that they have, right? So they're overcoming part of that deficit. Now, it's still only a partial prosthesis in the sense that it works within the context of the experiment they're carrying out because they trained the model to be able to help the patient with that experiment. And it needs to be that constraint because the probes, there are still very few. They're no longer just using the 60 or so probes. It's a bit more now. They have more advanced probes. So they have maybe a few hundred sites that they're recording from and stimulating. But it's still a tiny, tiny fraction of the number of neurons that are actually in those areas because there are several million neurons in CA3 and CA1. So if you wanted to have a prosthesis that could work in daily life under every circumstance and completely replace the hippocampus instead of supporting the hippocampal action, you'd want to have many, many more sites that you recorded from to create a model that was a perfect match to that hippocampus.
So you're essentially treating the brain as a mechanical device, and you can create these prostheses to take over parts of the brain that are not working properly, and they're now doing it in humans for the hippocampus?
That's essentially what they're after. And maybe it's better to not say mechanical device. Maybe we should, I say mechanism a lot because I don't want to bias us towards thinking only about electronics when there's a lot of chemistry going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think thinking of it as an electronic device, that you're looking at it like that and recording from it as if it were, say, a chip that you're analyzing, and you're trying to build a chip by analyzing. There's some competitor's chip that you're trying to replicate, and you have to record from it so that you can figure out what it's doing, and then you make your own version of that chip. That's basically what's going on here.
Is implants the right word to describe it, a neural implant?
They are implants, yes. They're neural implants.
Are there people that are getting these right now that have no problems with their brain, but they just want to have a better memory or be able to maybe selectively?
No, that's not possible at the moment because ethical guidelines currently make it impossible for Ted Berger to receive government funding and yet to do anything that isn't, first of all, in the context of a study and with patients who clearly will benefit from that study. You can't currently go out there and say, hey, who'd like to have an implant put in? Because there's definitely a risk associated with every surgery of that sort. This is a craniotomy that takes place. You have to open up the brain and you have to, put in devices. And then what happens if there's a malfunction and the device needs to be removed or anything like that? There's so many issues with that. It has to be treated as it's a carefully monitored process of clinical product development that he's going through.
Are there other ways being tested out to get these same effects besides implants? Like maybe a pill or some sort of nanotechnology thing like that? I don't know if that's too far ahead right now, but it seems like if you could not focus on the idea of having to crack open someone's brain, then maybe more people would be open to it, or it might be a more, not effective approach, but just something that's more acceptable in people's minds since so many people take pills every day and things like that.
That's definitely a major issue. So coming up with ways to, say, make something commercially viable out of the hippocampal prosthesis project is very difficult because it's such an invasive process doing it. Yeah, it's not easy to come up with alternatives. A regular type of pill, something that contains a chemical of some sort, that's not going to cut it because it's going to be very untargeted, diffuse, just hitting everywhere in the brain, hitting everything in the same way. Now, you could imagine that pill like that would contain, as you said, some sort of nanotechnology or biotechnology. Biotechnology is often the same as nanotechnology, except using organic compounds, right? It's tiny little molecular devices. Yeah, it's hard to say where that's going to go because we're really in the infancy of that technology. Now, if you take a step back, you know, we often were so narrow-minded in the sense that we look with tunnel vision at what's happening in the next 5 years, and is it going to happen while I can make use of this in my prime or something like that. But that's, you know, if we take a step back, then we can look at the timelines as they exist and since the beginning of the universe, since the beginning of the Earth, since the beginning of humanity, which goes back hundreds of thousands of years, since the beginning of history, which goes back 10,000 years. You know, it's 2,000 years since the Romans. and here we are right now. So nanotechnology, if we don't destroy ourselves, if we create new things, if we keep on doing that, then eventually some fantastic nanotechnology is definitely going to exist. Whether or not that's going to be the best approach to neural implants or whole brain emulation or mind uploading, that's not clear yet because we don't really know what the best route is at this moment. But I could say with fair certainty that at some point, some really fantastic nanotechnology would exist. And at some point, some really cool mind uploading is going to exist and some great, you know, building of brains and enhancing brains, it's all going to exist. And if you really look at it honestly and you say, okay, is it going to happen in 20 years? Is it going to happen in 100 years or 200 years? Mm-hmm. In reality, that all hardly matters. It's all within the blink of an eye on the, you know, sort of historical timeline. We're basically at the precipice of that stuff right now. Whether it's in 5, 20, or 100 years, we are at the cusp of all of these technologies.
Well, say for argument's sake that in 100 years, we will be able to fully upload a brain to an independent substrate. If you take that 100-year timeline, what would you think that the progression would look like as we go towards the future?
You mean after we have mind uploading, or you mean from now until that 100-year mark?
From now until then, I should have clarified.
Okay. Yeah, I think that what you're going to see first is you're going to see some of the things that, say, for instance, Neuralink is playing with right now, which is just connecting the brain more directly with something else. Because obviously the type of thing that we were just talking about, Ted Berger's device, is constantly fully connected to computers that carry out parts of the emulation and all of that. So, so there is a lot of brain-computer interfacing going on in that process. And Neuralink, it happens to be concentrating on how to make those brain-computer interfaces better. In other words, how do you make them higher bandwidth? How do you make the surgery less invasive? Those are the two main things they're looking at. So you're going to see some improvements there first. You're also going to see what Ted Berger's already working on. You're going to see devices developed for patients. So things that are helping out those with specific needs because they have deficits. That's going to happen first. You'll also see the application of many of the things that we discover there in other domains. So you'll see that some of the things that we come across as we're analyzing brain regions will be used in artificial intelligence. And then as we move along, you'll see that, as soon as a hippocampal prosthesis has great probes that have thousands, maybe millions of sites, so that they can really register from a high percentage of the number of neurons in a region of the brain. At that point, a prosthesis becomes so good that it can outperform the original brain because, for example, the computations taking place can be done faster, or you can add in new information from elsewhere. So it could seem like content that was in Wikipedia appears in your brain as if it was already in your memory. At that point, you get to a place where it's no longer, you know, the risk-benefit analysis, do I get this device implanted or not? It becomes one where it's worthwhile for healthy people because they know that this is not going to be some sort of clunky first-run device that's going to break and they're going to have a surgery for it, et cetera. Instead, if you're a lawyer in a courtroom and you have the implant, you're going to do better than your opponent, the other lawyer who doesn't have the implant, because you have way more info at your disposal and you're thinking things through faster or whatever. And at that point, it just takes off because then you start wanting more of those in different parts of your brain. And many people start exploring different avenues of how you can improve your yourself and how you can digitize things that are normally thoughts inside your brain. And at some point, you also get this other side, this sort of pure mind uploading, where people have decided that they want to preserve their brain and then have it scanned and recreated and restarted so that they will exist again. That's sort of a separate arc almost, because what we talked about now are all these devices that get implanted. It's for living patients. And the second arm of that is really brain preservation and recreation or reconstruction, so that you emerge again from this preserved brain state.
Is brain preservation reliable at the moment? I know some people pay to have their brains preserved, but I've heard some things where it doesn't actually work the way it should. How is that process?
Well, it's never worked the way it should yet, because no one has ever been brought back, right? So there's no evidence that anyone can be brought back so far. The best place to go for all the up-to-date information on that is the brainpreservation.org website. This is the Brain Preservation Foundation, run by Ken
Hayward. That makes sense.
And he's dedicated a lot of his time to making sure that the sort of things that are claimed and said and tried with regards to brain preservation, that they are actually scientifically justified and well-founded. And that's because he was somewhat frustrated with some of the early claims coming out of organizations, for example, organizations that are involved with cryonics, where, you know, there's a lot of promise there, but the quality of what was being preserved is hard to determine sometimes. Now, I should say that that cryonics institutes, those organizations, they really do try their best. And when they say you have a chance of coming back if you sign up with us, they're technically right, because if you're not religious and therefore you don't believe in some other way of being restored to life, then cryonics gives you at least something greater than 0% chance of coming back. Whereas not doing cryonics and, I don't know, being cremated or something, that really reduces your chance down to zero.
Yeah, imagine it's hard to bring back a cremated brain.
Exactly. So cryonics isn't entirely wrong in that sense. They are offering at least something to hang on to. But of course, there are so many things that get in the way. And the biggest thing nowadays actually is the time until cryonic preservation takes place. Often, you know, when someone dies, they're far from the cryonics institute that they signed up with. And so a team has to fly out there, and they have to be in a location where the hospital understands what's happening, and they keep them cool and all of that, run them through the first parts of the process. So oftentimes what may happen is that you get there and the brain has been dead but warm for hours, and then a lot of decay has already happened and you're losing information that can never be restored. So that's the main problem. That goes way beyond specific issues about the process of cryonic preservation. But Ken Hayworth can't do much about that with his organization, except that he's trying by trying to lobby for something like brain preservation to be something you can opt for in terminal patient care. And in that case, it would be available everywhere and you wouldn't have this kind of delay. So that's great. But the main thing he was interested in originally was, well, these processes for preserving the brain, do they actually preserve the ultrastructure of the brain, that which you would need if you wanted to bring someone back, connect them, the connections between your neurons? And, the methods that were being used so far hadn't really been tested. And he ran a prize contest through the Brain Preservation Organization, the foundation, and that prize allowed him to test different methods and use electron microscopy to look at what the results were and give an accurate report on what was the best method. And it turned out that a new method called aldehyde stabilized cryopreservation is probably the most reliable, the best version of that. One where they couldn't see any changes between the ultrastructure of the brain if it had not been subjected to that process and afterward. So it looked perfect in a way.
So it was an open competition, basically just saying if you can come up with a way to preserve the brain, you get X amount of prize money. That's pretty cool.
it's exactly what it was. And he was able to do that because he had a generous funder who felt that this was important.
So to go back to the lawyer example with two competing lawyers in the courtroom and one with a neural prosthesis, this may be the result of me watching too many Black Mirror episodes. But so say that a prosthesis is the right word, right?
They're both actually correct. There isn't really a correct one.
Okay, so I'll just go with neural prosthetics. Say that is to the point where it is still very expensive to get a neural prosthetic. So only people with a certain amount of wealth can afford it. Could it create sort of an information divide between people that are kind of like semi-superhuman and regular people, to where when it's first created, basically only a very small segment of the population can get its hands on it and blow everyone else away pretty much with brain function?
Yeah, totally possible. I mean, we have some of this already. We've got some people who get to go to good schools, some who don't, some who have access to the internet, some who don't. And you can see that every time something like that happens, a divide is created. And something like a brain implant could create an even bigger divide, especially if money is what ends up being the determining factor for who gets what. So ultimately, the question there isn't about the technology. The question is about how you give people access. So what is the social and political environment behind that, the legal environment? In a country where you have, say, socialized healthcare, perhaps everyone will have access to the same type of implants. And in a country that doesn't have government-run healthcare, maybe only the people who can pay for an expensive healthcare plan or who can privately pay for the implants can get them. And then you get a bigger divide. So, you know, nations, societies are going to have to think about what they want to do to reduce these sorts of gaps. It's the same question that we run into all the time now when we're thinking about how do we reduce the income gap? How do we reduce the information gap? How do we reduce the skills gap? How do we reduce all these gaps that exist, or gaps between genders and races and all this stuff? This is really important stuff that needs to be figured out. But it's in the realm of politics and jurisdictions, legal things, and you know, and social questions. It's not actually a technological or scientific question.
What are the things about your daily routine or the things that you've encountered in your field that keep you up at night the most? What things do you worry about? It could be technological, it could be ethical, the things that you worry about maybe more than you should.
I think running out of time is the thing that I worry about the most. And what I mean by that is, as I keep mentioning, the sort of the caveat for all of this is humanity continues to progress. I'm not super worried about whether these things happen within 20 years or 100 years. I'm a little bit worried about whether we apply them the right way. So do we get giant gaps and huge social upheaval or not? That could be, you know, cause a lot of cause suffering among people, and that would be bad. So I worry about that. But the biggest thing I worry about is that we do something as a society, marching forward almost blindly very often, just following our drives, where either our economy, our infrastructure, our science, or maybe all of them collapse in some way. And whether that's because of some calamity, some dystopian thing that happens there, or some more gradual degradation, you know, slipping back into some kind of dark ages. Those sorts of things have happened before. You know, there was a very long period of more savagery and less information after the fall of certain well-structured societies, such as the Roman Empire is usually the example that's given, but it's happened over and over again. You had the Mayan Empire and many others. So this stuff happens. And I do worry about that, because we're talking about things that take a while to develop and you rely on so much to make them happen. So I always feel a sense of urgency that somehow everything needs to be pushed forward. And that's the only reason why Carbon Copies exists. The Carbon Copies Foundation exists because I was kind of thinking, well, we need something, some place, some community that exists and that can persist over time. The reason I started Carbon Copies as a place that could be a community for people with the same interest, apart from any from any, you know, company or such thing, is because of that concern about time and wanting to push things forward. So it's an organization that exists with the sole purpose of caring about whole brain emulation and trying to make it happen faster, always looking for some angle that can help make things happen faster, either by introducing two scientists who didn't know each other but who would have really complementary work, or by launching a new project somewhere, or just by reaching out to the general public and letting them know about this stuff and trying to inform them that, you know, it makes sense and that there's some purpose to it and that it's useful or should be pursued. Yeah, that's why.
You mentioned the dark ages and how we're not in a period like that right now. It seems like we are living very globally. People are collaborating. I see online, especially from what it looks like in my limited research of the whole brain emulation community and people that have posted about carbon copies, that there are groups all over the world that are working on different sort of problems related to the brain. And so it seems like a good time to push things forward because we are not in a huge state of war and people are prospering more economically, at least now, than they have been before in history. And then we're also in a state where we can afford to worry about these things. Because if, say, things do get bad 100 or 200 years from now, then I would assume that a lot of this research and funds and time would have to be dedicated towards more survival than thriving.
I think you're right, yeah. You'd have to, I would say that then you'd have to focus on short-term survival of the species rather than long-term survival. Because the short-term survival of the species is about basic things that we already know about, such as, you know, good food supply, safety, procreation, etc., all that stuff. And long-term survival of the human species depends a lot on adaptation, because circumstances aren't going to stay the same. The kinds of challenges we deal with won't be the same. The sort of things that we want to accomplish, the Earth isn't going to be around all forever, and it's certainly not always going to remain the same. So long-term, for humanity's survival, we need to be very adaptable. And I think the most adaptable thing is what you can be through mind uploading and through being able to, you know, change the brain as needed. But short term, yeah, if you're dealing with it, you know, being stuck in the dark ages and you have to worry about food shortages, then you have to worry about those immediate things.
I was wondering about sort of the way that exploration is presented to us in school, at least. Going through middle school, high school, and college in America, there seems to be a focus on external exploration, like space and exploring other planets and things that are further out in the universe that are hard to grasp, and not as much as is presented about lanes where you can kind of explore your own mind, whether it's research in the area of whole brain emulation or sources like carbon copies. And it's ironic because I heard you speaking about how if we do have the ability to upload people's minds, we can better explore other planets. We can upload someone's brain into another substrate that is able to approach closer to the sun or another planet in an atmosphere where we couldn't explore before. And these two things seem like they're tied together, the exploration, space exploration, and extending beyond the physical limits of our planet, and also the internal exploration of our own minds. It seems like you can't really think about one without the other.
Again, this is the sort of stuff where if you actually just sit down and you just think rationally about it, then it all makes sense, and you wonder why you could ever have thought differently. Everything tends to work better when it is well aligned, when it's fit for its task or its environment. That's, of course, what evolution and natural selection is all about. If you're thinking about not something that lives on Earth and drinks from streams and hunts game, but instead you're thinking about something that has to undergo extreme acceleration, needs to be able to resist, you know, kind of radiation you find in space, needs to be able to travel very long distances or extreme amounts of time, then perhaps the human body isn't exactly what you would evolve. it's not exactly the thing that would be the best fit. In fact, you would be kind of selected out at that point. So if you want to do something other than send our machines, which we're already doing, to explore space, then it probably makes sense to try to build different bodies for our astronauts. So mind uploading makes sense in that way. I mean, all of our space exploration right now is taking place via robots, of course. So robots and AI will own the universe. You know, that's where we're going, unless we become part of that ecosystem of intelligences.
I saw an article on mind uploading that focused more on entertainment and kind of the fun things that you can do with it. Someone was writing about how you could go snowboarding, you know, halfway around the world in the Alps or something, and be in your apartment in New York if you could upload your mind and to another substrate that was actually on the mountain and feel like you were doing all of these things and other recreational activities. And yeah, it seems really cool to think about. And I'm glad that I came across this type of research and this type of way of thinking and exploration.
Yeah, I agree.
What are the biggest eureka or holy shit moments that you've had since you've been involved in this field?
Well, I guess the biggest one initially was just realizing that this wasn't about particles and physics and that much. It was more about neuroscience and brain analysis and brain building. So switching from a physics approach to neuroscience approach. Now that happened very early on. That was when I was maybe in my late teens, 19 or so, 20, and just figuring out which way to go in college. That took a little while to sort of make that switch, just because, you know, I had a strong physics bias coming from that whole upbringing with particle physicist in the house and everything. And even, you know, the novel was also about physics from there. So that was probably the biggest one for me personally.
What made you want to make that switch? Was there any sort of new information you came across or a conversation?
Well, simply that trying to do this by recreating things from the atoms up is a much more complicated way of going about it, when the real information you're looking for is cognitive functions. So it's at a whole different level. And just being exposed to computer science and psychology, that just helped make that really clear. And then sort of the whole particle stuff there that fell by the wayside. But you asked about other eureka moments, and I think there is one more that's important. And it's not so much a eureka moment about technology or about the method or approach. It's a eureka moment about the reason and the purpose. And I think that maybe in the last 5 to 10 years, I've been focusing on the reasons for whole brain emulation as being more about extending the lifespan of the human species and making us also adaptable, that the human species can be a part of a future that contains a lot of different intelligences, that it's sort of an ecosystem of intelligences that we need to be able to adapt to, as opposed to looking at it just as, oh, this is a cool mind, you know, sorry, a cool life extension technology. Because for instance, in science fiction, when you look at the Arthur C. Clarke book and you look at many other versions of mind uploading in science fiction, it's usually presented as a life extension technology, something that allows people, individuals, to live longer. And sure, it can be that, but that's really not the most important reason for doing it. That's only important to that individual. It's subjectively important. But to all of us together as a society, it's more important that this gives you the tools to be ultimately adaptable. And not just you as in the person, but you, all of us together, the society, humanity, so that we don't just fall by the wayside and become irrelevant, either because some other intelligence becomes more dominant, more important, has, you know, chooses the direction for everything, or because the circumstances change, because our environment changes, or we're no longer fit for those challenges. That's more important, really. It's the reason to do it.
Going off of purpose, it seems like, not to get too spiritual, but that this type of technology, whole brain emulation, would allow people to love each other better in a sense and spread more love and compassion in the world if it's being used in the right way, with, you know, you being able to sort of focus energy on more of the things that you want to do and capacity on the things you want to do and have better access to memories and moments and be able to connect with people more intensely. It sounds like there can be an intense focus on the technological side, like you were pointing out, to extend people's lives and the overall purpose of extending people's lives in the future and extending humanity. But while you're here and while you're interacting with other people, it seems like it can have a huge effect on loving, like spreading more love and compassion on the planet. And I think a lot of people want to be able to say they did that during their life.
Yeah, I think you've got an important point there, because loving other people has a lot to do with understanding other people, with feeling close to them. It's this whole, you know, we're kind of tribal, but you can break down some of those barriers, those tribal barriers that we build up, if you understand the other person better. And you can understand better if you can convey more clearly what they mean, what's actually going on. So what are their intentions, their thoughts, what are they trying to present and why? And with a better understanding of the brain and of how our individual brain processes are actually working, you can convey that with much greater clarity and more quickly and more intensely. So I think that's definitely true. You can make a much stronger connections between people when you achieve that. I think that human connections have already grown as we improved our means of communication. I would say that the reason why we now have a somewhat greater empathy for people and we perhaps don't treat killing, for instance, as such a normal thing as it may have been in older times, when you would just go out and you would kill the infidels, or you would, and yes, it still happens in some parts of the world sometimes now, but when you used to go out, and Christianity's purpose was to kill the infidels because that they didn't matter at all, or even just, you know, a peasant wasn't as valuable as an aristocrat, or in the Roman arena, of course, gladiators would kill each other. It was all treated very differently than it is now. And part of that, I think, comes from the fact that we express more of what goes on in people's minds, and we do it through means such as reading, because we can write down our thoughts and our feelings, and then you can pore over them, and you can put yourself in that place, and you can empathize. So this whole aspect of deeply, you know, getting a lot more people in society involved in stories, in this kind of communication, even that has changed us in a sense. And I think every time when we increase how we communicate with one another, that changes us in some sense. It makes us a larger, tighter community, so that the community isn't just your tribe of 11 people, 12 people, 15 people. It's a much bigger tribe.
I remember reading a while ago, I'm blanking out on the name of the book, but it was about early human history and how there were multiple species of humans on the planet. Homo sapiens likely, in a sense, won out by, there's evidence to suggest that we were extremely genocidal early on in existence, and we weren't reading and writing at that point. We weren't able to connect on the same level we were now. So we would run into other tribes of different species and essentially just kill them off and spread. And Homo sapiens are still alive today, where, you know, it's not a normal thing in history for there to only be one species of human on the planet. If you look back, this is kind of a unique time, but it makes sense as we progress more and evolve that we'll be able to understand each other better, to feel more, to connect more. And neural prosthesis and this field seems like a great way to explore that and extend that even further beyond our own biology.
I agree.
So to wrap up, I have a couple questions for you that are designed to be quicker, but we'll see. If you could make one change to your brain right now and effectively just flip a switch, what change would that be?
Oh, that's a tough one because there are two that I think are almost equally interesting to me.
What two?
So I'll mention both. I'm just going to break your rules and I'm going to mention both.
Yeah, that's fine. They've been broken many times before.
So one thing I would do, one option is I would make my brain faster. I would allow every neuron to operate 10 or 100 times as quickly as it normally does. Because when you do that, you open up an entirely new part of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You open up time scales that we don't operate on, where, say, machines are used to working on things in microseconds or nanoseconds, and mm-hmm. they can respond to things that happen at those time scales, and we can't. For us, that world doesn't exist. The world only exists from tenths of seconds upward. So that's one thing I would potentially change.
That makes me think of the movie Clockstoppers. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but essentially the main character can speed up time compared to everything else. So he's seeing things that are happening, like what you were saying, he's experiencing things in much shorter fractions of time
mm-hmm.
where people are essentially just walking really slow next to him on the sidewalk and he's just looking around and all these and comprehending all these things. I don't know if that would have the same effect. But I get what you mean.
Well, you know, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be the same for the body. You'd have to, if you wanted to do that, you'd have to create a really fast body too, but.
Or find the watch that he was wearing that allowed him to do that.
Exactly, yeah. But so that's one thing that I find really interesting. The other one would simply be to have actual memory. So memory that really works, because the way our memory works is a little weird. We take impressions. And we sort of abstract them, and then we store attractors in a neural network that are the places that we go to when we try to remember something. So we create the icons mm-hmm. of what something is. So we have some sense of what a car is and what a table is. But if you asked me to recite exactly what happened yesterday, that would be really, really, really hard. And I'd get it wrong. Mm-hmm. I would be manufacturing my memories. I'd just be coming up with stuff that seems plausible, reasonable, because those are the sorts of things that happen. But they're not actually the things that happen. So I don't have real memory. And it would be interesting to have real memory.
Before I ask the last question, because I'm really bad at making this quick, I've heard that when you remember something, you're not remembering the actual event, you're just remembering the last time you remembered it. Is that true?
Oh, gosh. Well, as I mentioned, you're not really remembering the event anyway.
That's because true.
It's all been filtered down into a strange abstraction of what it was. You're reconstructing an event. That's what you're doing. You're constructing something inside your mind. But I don't know where this thought would have come from that you're remembering the last time you remembered it. That I don't quite get that.
The last question I had is, if you had to give a TED talk on any topic besides your job and the field of whole brain emulation and things related to it, what topic would you pick? And I know you've already given a TED talk, so this would be your second one.
I would give a TED talk on perspective, all kinds of perspective. So you know how I was mentioning the sort of the you know, we've got astronomical time, geological time, historical time, and this little moment that we live in. And I know somebody's probably already done this TED talk, but so that temporal perspective and then spatial perspective, where we are, what we are, there are all sorts of different aspects to just taking perspective that I find are so refreshing and illuminating. I would love to give a TED talk on perspective.
Coming soon. Talk to the people at TED.
Are you inviting me to a TED talk?
I wish I had that kind of power. I feel like I would invite some, I don't know. I like TED talks. Some of them, I enjoyed your TED talk and I try to watch one about every week or so if I'm eating lunch or something, but I feel like some of them get you with the title and then they just go into something for 30 seconds that kind of has to do with the title and then it goes into something else. But so I have to talk with the people that are uploading the TED Talks. But if I had the power to invite people to give TED Talks, you would 100% be on the list for perspective. I think we could all use some more perspective.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode with neuroscientist Randall Kuna. For more information on what we discussed, you can find everything you need to know at carboncopies.org. Link in the description of this podcast. I encourage you to go through and expand your knowledge on all the topics we discussed. It affects you and me, and it's something we should all have at least a general knowledge of. And if you haven't already, leave us a quick rating and subscribe in the iTunes store, or even better, tell a friend about this podcast. Thank you for making this podcast possible by supporting Auxoro. We really do love what we do, and every person that tunes in fuels the fire of Auxoro, keeps us going, keeps us motivated. This is why we do it, for the people that listen. Much love. Have a tremendous week or weekend whenever you're listening to this. And until next time.